Good morning. As eyes turn toward next week's opening of the legislative session, the newly reorganized Honolulu City Council gets back to work. Will the priorities for the Budget Committee change with new leadership? Later in the hour, Budget Committee Chair Joey Monahan details his action items. And continuing our look at the expectations and priorities of the 2017 legislative session, Senator Laura Thielen gives us the view from the Women's Legislative Caucus. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Improvisational duo Electro Violet is making its Hawaii debut with a performance that highlights the need to make up life as you go along. And L. Nicole Cabe's solo performance takes a prescient view of the impact of climate change on all of us.
It's Tuesday, January 10th. Stay here for the conversation coming up after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
We can look ahead to a pretty different climate in Washington and the one that may make us feel as if we're out here on our own.
Well, a lot of people feel that way and are feeling a real deep sense of unease with all of this.
Yeah.
And where we go from here is part of the conversations that we've been having ever since the election in November. Well, we're going to have one of those this morning, too. Now, you know that about this time every year, attention turns to the coming legislative session. But this year, the new session starts just as a new administration is taking power in Washington, a very different administration that may be far less in sync with many of the values of Hawaii. As we've talked about on this program before, Hawaii may see fewer federal dollars and have to do more for itself. Continuing our look at how local lawmakers are viewing the new session and the way it may pave the way for future sessions, Senator Laura Thielen, Senate co-chair of the Women's Legislative Caucus, joins us now. Good morning. Thank you for coming in.
Good morning, Beth Ann and Chris. Thank you for having me.
As we just mentioned, that sense of people feeling deeply uneasy about the coming administration, what that means for Hawaii, what that means for our view of civil liberties, women's rights, certainly the women's marches that are being promoted now by the Women's Caucus. It all brings into question so many issues. Last year, the Women's Caucus was so instrumental in working to end the backlog, for example, of the untested rape kits, and also shaping how new kits will be tested, what happens from this point forward. How does this changed climate inform or perhaps shape what happens for the Women's Caucus this year and as we move into the future?
Well, I think we have to take a look at, what's going on federally. And one of the concerns we have is there is a Federal Violence Against Women's Act that has changed state laws, our federal laws across the country encourage change behaviors, taking violence against women more seriously and trying to end that violence and have consequences for that violence to change behaviors. But I think we also have to be a little optimistic and say, what can we do locally? And there's a lot of opportunity to change things locally. So we don't have a state Violence Against Women's Act. We have a commitment. We have a lot of good laws. But we need to take a look going forward. If we can't rely on the same federal funding sources, what can we do locally to make sure that we are reducing violence against women, that we have real consequences for violence against women? So this year, we're going to take a look at, are the existing Hawaii state laws effective? Are there things that we can change to make them more effective? And we want to make sure that the changes that we've started, such as the testing of the untested rape kits, are actually implemented statewide across the counties and that we do smarter law enforcement so that we have consequences against people who are committing violence against women, children, and others.
You alluded to the fact that we have some pretty good laws, but how they are enforced and how that continues into the future with greater consequences, perhaps even as you say, do we need a state law for violence against women? that all seems to be a direction that we've been building toward for some time. What has to happen in this session that actually moves that forward beyond knowing that we need to move it forward?
Well, the Women's Legislative Caucus has been having meetings. Yesterday we met with the judiciary, and we're trying to figure out what is happening with these domestic violence cases. And the reality is a lot of them are pled down to a lesser offense, a petty misdemeanor, and no consequences. So we want to work with the advocates, with the law enforcement, to decide, is there another way, aside from what we have in our laws right now, where we can have different charges pressed against offenders, first-time offenders, perhaps offenders with no weapons, where we can have immediate consequences. So perhaps we can stem somebody who is not a serial domestic violence offender, but stop it before it goes too far. So I think we need to get into the nitty-gritty details about how law enforcement is handling these cases, why there isn't consequences, and what adjustments can we make to our existing laws to make sure that there are consequences to these kinds of actions so that they stop. Because the ultimate goal is to stop violence against women. We have, unfortunately, a serious problem with sexual assault, with domestic violence, and it's kind of swept under the table, but it's affecting a lot of lives, not just for the victims of domestic violence, but also the children who are in the households. Because when they witness this day in, day out,
they think it's normal.
They think it's normal, and that's the best predictor of, are they going to go on to either become a victim or to become an aggressor themselves and perpetuate the trend. And so we need to stop it.
Do we have a really good number of how many women and families are included in that, aside from the, you know, the statistics that we always hear about how many women will be experiencing other domestic violence or be raped within a lifetime?
One of the challenges we have, and again, the Women's Legislative Caucus has been working with the police departments on all four counties, the prosecutors, as well as the judiciary, is all the data is kept in silos. So one of the discussions we're having is if we have a state Violence Against Women Act and we move towards that, we need to have a better report card so that we're able to take information from these different jurisdictions and compile them. We do have a uniform crime statistics report. So again, it's a matter of adjusting the laws, adjusting the data reporting so that we can get a clearer picture. And we as a state can start to make some deeper progress, you know, and constructive progress on these issues without having to rely on the federal government to come in to rescue us.
Will we see a bill to bring a state law against violence,
I think,
or women against women?
What we are definitely going to see is a number of smaller bills and working the continuation of certain working groups to get standards and practices like the testing of the rape kits. We're going to see some laws to follow up on that, and we may build towards a state Violence Against Women Act. We are continuing to work to show at the federal level that there is strong support for these programs. So the state is also hosting a women's march. If you support women's issues, you support actions to help women, children, families. On Saturday, January 21st, there's going to be a march that starts at the state capitol at 10 a.m. and then a rally that follows at 11:30 a.m. So please feel free to join us on Saturday, January 21st.
Beyond the rallies, beyond getting everybody together on that day, which we've talked about and going on in many states and certainly in Washington, the idea that there needs to be concrete steps is the point that you've just outlined. Where do we go from here? What I'm hearing you say is that we may not get to a bill this year that would bring a state law against for violence against women, but that it may be building to that for subsequent sessions and to be able to build on what the AG, what the Attorney General's office, will be doing for the untested rape kits going forward and the new kits that come in the coming years.
The Women's Legislative Caucus will have a package of 10 bills for this session in 2017. And those bills will probably have aspects of what would subsequently be put into a Violence Against Women's Act if we take that step. But we certainly are going to have at least 10 bills this year that the Women's Legislative Caucus will be promoting around stopping violence against women and around women's health issues. And so we will be having some legislation to follow up on the testing of the untested rape kits, because that's not been completed. All we got after the law we passed last year was an inventory, and a working group that is saying that they're going to be making some changes. But we want to make sure this transitions from talk to actual implementation, because too often we fall down between those two steps.
But that's going to have to be a roll-on of that, because clearly with 1,900 kits, it's going to be a measured and paid for.
There'll be a rollout of the testing of the backlog, but we want to make sure that they implement standards and practices so we don't create a new backlog that we're dealing with in 5 years from now. The other jurisdictions that test rape kits have found that the testing uncovers serial rapists, which then helps smart prosecution and targeted prosecution to reduce sex assault. And that's our goal.
I want to thank you for coming in. We'll be checking with you as session moves through.
Thank you very much.
Senator Laura Thelen represents the 25th Senatorial District from Kailua through Waimanalo to Hawaii Kai. She is the Senate co-chair of the Women's Legislative Caucus and will be active on many of the bills that we've just talked about. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's now 8:16. Coming up, a Hawaii debut from an improvisation dance and music duo. But first, your backyard quiz.
Our visit from Hawaii State Senator Laura Thelen, member of the legislature's Women's Caucus, got us thinking about other famous women in Hawaii's political history, and that's what we're looking at in today's quiz. The woman we're thinking of was one of the most influential political figures in the state's history, male or female. She's the favorite wife of King Kamehameha I, Kuhina Nui, Prime Minister of the Kingdom of Hawaii. She's known for being an advocate of women's rights in the kingdom, a struggle that eventually led to sweeping cultural changes to Hawaii society. Today, we're looking for the name of this trailblazer, and if you know it, call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and the first one to get it right gets the prize.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, currently raising funds for a new kidney resource center in Kapolei and for the Senator Daniel K. Akaka Community Center, kidneyhi.org.
As any improvising artist will tell you, life is filled with opportunities to make it up as you go along, so you might as well get good at it. Electro Violet is an improvisational duo, movement from Peiling Kau, sound from Gretchen Jude, that's about to make its debut in Hawaii with a performance called Electric 1.1. Its message, the need to develop responsiveness to unknown futures. Peiling Kau is on the line with us now. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Chris.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
So you're anticipating an unknown future, yeah?
That's right, yeah. Because I just relocated here in August 2016. I'm very new to Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of unknown situation. I don't know what will happen here, but so far, very good.
One of the things that happens when you make a move is that you're kind of called upon, your resources get taxed, right? You need to do a lot of improvising just in day-to-day life, don't you?
Yeah. It's like when you go out in the morning, go to work, and then you suddenly realize that the traffic is really bad. And then you have to improvise your mind and improvise to find a way to go to work. So I feel like we are constantly dealing and practicing improvisation skill in
sure.
our daily life.
Yeah, you know, some people are express themselves as being baffled by what an improviser does, you know, jazz musician, dancer, whatever.
Mm.
But I often think, well, it's just what everybody does, just applied to a specific art form, right? We're always improvising, aren't we?
Yeah, I think especially particularly for movement improvisation, yeah, of course, when we are talking about that deal with everyday life, but I think in terms of talking about art making, dance improvisation is really about listening, sensing, and perceiving, and also is a very disciplined training, body movement, physical training.
Sure. And responding to sound, music and sound, right?
Yeah. So we are really working with what we have at the present moment and make a real-time composition.
Mm-hmm. The thing about making a composition in real time is structure. Yeah, can you impose a kind of structure on an event improvisation like that?
Yeah, I think the structure we call probably say score. So the scores we're having is to tuning in what we how we feel at the present moment, and we just be there, be very present about who we are, how we feel at the present moment, and be available and to be seen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The only analogy that I'm familiar with is musical improvisation, and in that we'll have kind of moments that are kind of signals to the other musicians that maybe my solo is over, or I've come to the middle, or let's go to a different part of the structure. Do you have anything like that?
Yes, we can say that, because in movement improvisation, there are many different ways to assign your score or to design your structure. But for this particularly piece, Body Electric 1.1 in Fringe Festival we are going to do this week, is a just a solo dance and then a solo movement.
Mm-hmm.
So we have been practiced for many times at the studio, and then we talk about it after our rehearsal. And I think for us, it's like we have to be really clear about what is the beginning and what is the end, and how do we feel about the overarching the form of the piece.
Yeah. So that's a very definite structure, because I do think that people need something to hang on to in terms of where we are in the piece. Is that the idea?
Yeah. I think for us, we really hope, the electro-violet really hope that we are bringing this abstraction. So the audience probably won't see a story line or narrative in our piece, but we're really hoping that people will sense something or feel anything that responds to them and reflects to their experience of viewing. So it's not necessarily a story line they would see, mm-hmm. or they will see at the show. Yeah, but we really hope that the audience will feel something.
Well,
maybe unfamiliar, yeah.
In the absence of an imposed storyline, audience members are kind of free to substitute their own, yeah?
Yeah. We are really appreciate and then thinking that the audience has has the wisdom to interpret it, what they see, what they feel. So we don't want to dictate or to tell the audience how to feel, how they should think about it, the show it is. But ironically, we really want them to have the ownership of their own feeling.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's always a sort of extrasensory thing that you feel coming back from an audience. And
right.
When you've had a successful performance, what kind of, you know, what comes back to you?
So this is a very interesting question to so-called successful performance.
Mm-hmm.
I think we are really trying to blur the line between the practice and performance. And, of course, the audience, with the audience presence, we can so-called the performance. And then I think we can, we oftentimes say, oh, we feel great about it, but we probably won't say it's successful. We feel great, we feel the energy, and then we feel the energy that flow between the audience and us, and then the audience feedback is really important for us to keep going and then to digest what we have been working on.
Well, I'm kind of defining success as something that gets a response from
right.
the audience, that the audience is fully
right.
aware of.
Yeah. Yeah. But if the audience say, oh, I don't get it, or I don't know what is that, and then I think I cannot call it as an unsuccessful performance because I think as a more art-making, as an artist, we are not trying to please everybody, and it's impossible.
That it is. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
My pleasure. Pei Ling Cao is a movement artist and half of the improvisational duo Electro Violet, which will perform this Friday and Saturday at the Ong King Arts Center in Honolulu's Chinatown. The evening will include an improvised performance by Pei Ling and Gretchen Jude, providing the sound. You can find out more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
In 2008, the new president-elect told a crowd in Chicago that there would be setbacks ahead.
But America, I have never been more hopeful than I am tonight that we will get there.
8 years later, the president returns to Chicago for his farewell speech. I'm Audie Cornish. Join us for live special coverage tonight on NPR News and watch a live fact check at NPR.org.
This afternoon at 4, following Fresh Air.
On the heels of the announced retirement of HPD's chief, the ongoing federal investigation continues, and that has some wondering why the rush to get a secret settlement with the chief, which could include a big cash payout. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has the reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Okay, so there are two big questions here. Why the haste, and why negotiate in secret?
Well, in answer to the second question, Nick Gruby talked to a number of folks, including Max Sword, the police commission head, and two of the members, Stephen Levinson and Loretta Sheehan. And while everyone is not in agreement, and while Sword is the spokesperson for the commission, one thing that Levinson said was, you know, you need the secrecy in order to reach an amicable deal. This is the only way you can really come up with a plan that is acceptable to all parties. Sword did say the vote on the retirement package will be made public. That's next week. The public will have a chance to comment on that, and details will be released at that time. So I suppose that gives some comfort to those that worry that we're not following sunshine law, that we should really be having this discussion in the public, given such an important position. Now, to your second question, What was your second question, Beth Ann?
The idea that, first let's talk about what you just said, that we only have really a week until we'll find out what the details
why
of that summit will be.
Why the rush?
And And so, but there are some who are saying, look, this investigation is ongoing. There are things that we may not know. Is there a real reason to have so much, haste to be able to say, here's the settlement and that part's over and done with and we move on, although that federal investigation will also be continuing?
Right. Well, I'm glad you brought that point up. And one of the things that Sheehan said, she was actually the only one to vote against the retirement plan for Louis K. Aloha. She says she's concerned about paying someone probably a large amount of money while the indictment of the chief is still possible, and that this doesn't cast the right message from the commission. On the other hand, I should say that Levinson said, we got to start the healing process at HPD. There's a serious morale problem. This is a small price to pay. In terms of the price, we don't know yet exactly, but KLO has been on a city employee for 33 years, making currently $182,000 a year. By one estimate, his pension could be $150K a year, which is a substantial payout. There might also be an indemnification language in the buyout to prevent him from taking legal action. So a variety of opinions on why they are rushing to do this, a sense that they need to get this done, but all the while that federal investigation is not going away.
Which means that, that idea about healing may or may not be something that can happen even if you were to remove and have a settlement with the chief.
That's an important point, because remember, there are four other police officers that have been named in this inquiry. And as Nick has reported, this could extend beyond HPD into other city agencies, naming other officials. It's still in the early stages, as we've been reporting. And one wonders whether even buying out Louis K. Aloha is even going to settle this, that morale problems may continue at HPD. This could be a serious black eye on the city going forward.
All right. Well, at this point, we have to continue on and see what happens next, and we'll talk about it. Thanks, Chad.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat with a reality check.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Bronster Fujichaku Robbins, a civil litigation law firm handling major cases on all islands for clients of all sizes, from individuals to Fortune 500 corporations. BFRHawaii.com.
Senate nomination hearings begin, and Jeff Sessions is a headliner.
These comments that you could say about a commie organization or something, I may have said something like that in a general way, and that probably was wrong.
Remarks from more than 30 years ago follow the senator from Alabama in his quest to become attorney general. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after the conversation.
For many years, the relationship between the Honolulu City Council and Mayor Caldwell was often described as contentious. Now, with the mayor's second term underway and the council's reorganization, which includes a new chair and a new budget chair, is the combative period over? Is the relationship among those who will create Honolulu's future giving way to a more aligned action on rail, on housing development, and how the city spends its money? With his take on the next era, new budget chair Joey Manahan joins us now. Good morning. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Beth, and Happy New Year, everybody.
The relationship with the mayor was often the attention-getting aspect, not necessarily what they were talking about, but the fact that there was so much contentious behavior with the council. With that now seemingly, over, how do you view the relationship with the mayor without being seen as some have said, a rubber stamp of what the mayor would like to see happen?
Right. Thank you very much for having me on this morning, and it's certainly a pleasure to be here. I think with, my takeaway from the last election, Beth, was that people wanted to see not just the city council, but in government in general. They want to see less dysfunction. They want to see less politics, and they want to see us actually working towards solutions. And so that's really what the change on the city council with the change on the city council that we really hope to bring. There's kind of a general consensus that we want to work more collaboratively with the administration, but certainly not be a rubber stamp, right? So I think we're going to see that certainly as we deliberate our next upcoming budget. There's a few increases in the cost of doing business for the city that we're going to see certainly new proposals, new revenue enhancements that we're going to have to talk about and seriously consider in different areas. For example,
so let's talk about a couple of those and just break them down a little bit. I mean, first of all, what's on everybody's mind, obviously, rail.
Yes.
And the fact that we keep seeing the escalation of costs. Some projections now have it at, you know, $9.5 billion. And who knows? I mean, the bottom line is who knows. But where that money is going to come from, certainly not the federal government. And going back to the idea of having to do more for ourselves, and will we make the choice to do that? How do you see revenue generation coming? And is that going to be in the form of, as you say, enhancements, which other people are going to read as simply taxes?
Right. And so one of the challenges, apart from constructing the 20 miles and the 21 stations, is operating and maintaining the new mass transit system, which will be an integrated bus and rail system, right? And so that's going to cost us upwards of $100 million additional a year to operate and maintain, which the legislature is asking us to do. So for us to be able to come up with those funds, we are looking at revenue enhancements in the transportation area. Specifically, we're looking at increases possibly to our county gas tax. The vehicle weight tax is another source of revenue for us, as well as parking fees and possibly extending parking hours to be able to generate more money from our parking meters, for example, or parking lots. So we're looking to generate about an extra $60 million in revenue enhancements from these three areas, as well as other areas in the city to be able to fund the operations and maintenance. And you know, to be able to have these discussions, you know, we need to be a little bit less political, I think, and more, work-minded and solutions-minded and solutions-based.
When you talk about new costs that the city is going to have to bear, that backs end right into what happened after the last election, where we decided that, I mean, those of us who are on Oahu, that there needed to be some new charter amendments. And one of those has to do with creating a housing department. Some people may not realize that, you know, you have a pool of money there. Some of it's got to go now to new salaries. How do you decide how to do all of that equitably and also be able to fund the projects which are so badly needed to create housing, especially given the fact that we know that we have so many units that we need to create and that we're coming into perhaps, you know, that the top end of the bubble and we're most likely going to be moving at some point into a recession? And what does that mean for homelessness and all the fact that this is all tied together?
That's absolutely right. Okay, so I'm glad you brought up the charter amendments. The charter amendments were the clearest signal to me that people want to change, at least in the leadership. If you look at the 17 out of the 20 charter amendments that passed, a lot of them were trying to resolve a lot of the gridlock, a lot of the arguments we were having on the council between the administration and the mayor. For example, one of the things that people voted for was for the creation of a housing department for us to be able to implement more housing projects in here in Honolulu and on Oahu. That was a major contentious issue for us, between us and the administration. The council didn't want to see so much of a department as much as they wanted to see the funding go straight to projects, right? I think in that process, we realized that we do need a structure. I think people also realized that outside, and they voted for the creation of this department. And so rather than funding projects, now we're actually going to have to fund a department. We're going to have to create these new positions. We're going to have to fund salaries and benefits apart from affordable housing projects and asset management. And so that's also the other area where we're going to have to look for additional revenues to be able to fund actual projects, right, and not just the salaries and benefits and the administration of the overall department. But I think that's a good thing. I think there's a lot of opportunities for us to be able to work with the state with this new department and really also leverage our funds with the state to be able to create more housing projects. And what we were kind of discussing in the last year or so was that partnership between the state and centralizing the Affordable Housing Fund with the state funds and come up with a single application so that developers could come and bid on these projects and really really take the politics out of it, right? So you have a structure like the Housing Authority where developers can come, bid on projects that we put out there for affordable housing.
And how far away are we from having such a thing?
Well, we're just getting our – well, the people just voted for a new department to be able to as part of that structure. So we have to create that department, and then we have to go and work with the Housing Authority intergovernmentally.
So realistically, if you have to put a timeline on this just to give people a sense that this is not happening tomorrow and it may not even be happening next year or potentially the year after.
Yeah. So I think we're going to have to get the department up and running by June. And that's in a very quick time frame, or at least know what it's going to look like by then. And then from then, you know, they're going to have to, I guess, come online, as so to speak. But, you know, I'm hoping to do that without without the department in about a year. But with the creation of a new department, it might take a little bit more time, hopefully not that much more.
Given the fact that, as we alluded to a little earlier, that, you know, we may be at the top part of that bubble now and moving into more recessionary times as we move into the next couple of years and beyond. At the same time, you know, it seems like you've created that perfect confluence there where you've got looking for more revenue and then knowing that you're seeing that we're going to be challenged in getting that revenue. What do you do to be able to justify how we do what we do? Obviously, we're coming into a time, I'm sure, where you're going to say to me that we're going to have to make tough choices.
Yes. And so I think now is the time to consider these revenue enhancement proposals at the city and the state. I know the state is also going to be considering some of those. But, you know, you have to do it, I think, when the economy is still good. And, you know, having lived here in Hawaii for many years now and having gone through a few cycles myself, you know, we're enjoying a good economy. Our forecast seems to be good, at least stable. You're right. We're right at the top, or we're right in the bubble. And, you know, we're just kind of bracing for ourselves for when it's going to burst. But, you know, we need to prepare ourselves now. Should that happen, I hope it doesn't. But really, I mean, we're still largely dependent on a good tourism, good visitor arrivals, you know, that the visitor arrivals stay where they are. But also our construction is also driving our economy right now, right? So if anything happens to those two sectors in that industry, then we are very vulnerable. And at that point in time, would we be able to consider these enhancements? I'm not sure. But we would still need to come up with those revenues to be able to provide the core services that we do.
We've got to go for the moment, but we'll talk to you again in future. Thanks so much for coming in this morning.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me.
And Joy Manahan represents District 7 on the Honolulu City Council. That includes Kalihi, Aiea, Salt Lake, and Liliha. And this year, he'll take over as chair of the City Council's Budget Committee.
Hi, it's Lynn Rosetto Casper. This week, it's Global Breakfasting with Kenji Lopez-Alt, the lion-hearted Betty Fussell and her 50 years of writing about food, and America's Test Kitchen tells us what we need to know about bitter. Join us. That's The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites from 8 p.m.
Saturday morning at 9, following weekend edition.
Today in the Backyard Quiz, we asked you to give us the name of Hawaii's first Kohina Nui, who also happened to be the favorite wife of Kamehameha I. She was born in Hanamaui in 1768 and married to Kamehameha I at age 13. She would later go on to serve both kings Kamehameha II and III in the role of Kohina Nui, presiding over some of the most momentous events in Hawaii's history. She married the king of Kauai in order to preserve unity, was an early adopter of Christian beliefs, helped negotiate the kingdom's first treaty with the United States, and was instrumental in abolishing the kapu system. We asked you for her name. It is Kaahumanu.
And Beth Ann Matlau from Kaimuki knew the answer, and at 8:49, that's today's quiz. If you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating more than 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on HPR.
Global warming, rise in ocean levels, these are an abstraction to many of us, a looming reality we haven't yet been able to fully understand. Nicole Cabe's upcoming performance at the Oahu Fringe Festival is built on her love of science fiction, imagining a future in which the damage has already been done. It's a solo performance, and I spoke with her earlier this morning.
I think climate change is going to have a very dramatic effect on how we live our lives. It's going to dramatically change culture. And I wanted to speculate on what that might look like over the course of about 100 years, so three generations.
We haven't done that much speculating about what it would feel like. It seems like an abstraction to me.
It's true. It's true. I think because a lot of us tend to live our lives in sort of the short term, like what's next year going to look like maybe at most.
Yeah.
We haven't really considered how climate change is going to affect us. Like, I'm 33, so I'm going to see when I'm in 20 or 30 years the effects of that. I think it's going to change a lot in my lifetime. A lot of people don't consider how our kids' lives are going to change.
Yeah.
And what that might look like. And that's the point of writing science fiction, really, is that we get to think about how these changes might look in the future, not just next year or 5 years from now, but what things are going to look like 50 years from now or 100 or 1,000.
There's so many examples, as you know, in science fiction of mm-hmm. science fiction writers being really prescient about the future.
Yeah, absolutely.
Arthur C. Clarke is mm-hmm. anticipating, Asimov coined the term robot, and they're everywhere now.
Exactly.
Right?
Well, we're getting pretty close. I don't think we have artificial intelligence yet, but people are working on it.
Well, we're certainly hearing more and more about the whole idea of being a science fiction writer is being able to use science to make pretty accurate, or as accurate as you can, projections, right?
Sure, sure. And I'm not a scientist per se. I'm definitely more of a theater person and an artist, but I really enjoy reading science-based articles and sort of thinking about, wow, in 5 years, you know, what is that going to change like? There's new developments in how computers operate. There's a thing called quantum computing that people are working on, where you have a crystal and there's, you know, one atom in the crystal and there's an atom in another crystal and they vibrate together. And that's a way of storing information that is hopefully will be a lot faster than the computers we have now. So, you know, in 5 years, when somebody gets that up and running, what's that going to do to how we communicate?
So the science fiction writer takes maybe an article in Scientific American mm-hmm. based in reality mm-hmm. and then just sort of extrapolates where that could go, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So how does that apply in the case of rising ocean levels, climate change?
Well, thinking about how ice would melt, for example, before I even got on the plane to come here, there was an article about a giant crack in the Antarctic ice sheet that nobody predicted would happen. So there's going to be a huge shelf that's just going to slough off and melt into the ocean. So we might actually see sea rises of a few inches in the next couple of years because of that. I think the prediction at worst would be 10 to 20 feet of rise, which also with, changing ocean currents, as the ocean gets hotter, storms are going to shift around and change and get bigger and a lot more devastating. So I sort of took that and speculated what, you know, with shifting coastlines and people having to retreat further into the center of the country, what that might look like. With changing weather patterns because of the ocean warming, the center of the country is probably going to become a desert. So that's something I brought up in one of the pieces, is that the middle of the country has become a Sahara-like desert, and then the coasts are the only place that are really habitable.
So you portray three different women in this performance?
Yes, that's correct.
Different ages?
Yeah. The first character is probably in her early 20s. The second character is a little bit closer to my age, like mid-30s. And then the final character is in her 50s.
So for the character, the youngest of these characters, you know, looking ahead 50 years, mm-hmm. that's profound change, isn't it?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How will that reflect in the life of the youngest character?
Well, she already has to flee. So she spent her entire life living sort of a mobile gypsy existence. Mm-hmm. She and her parents have to flee the Texas floodplain, because I assumed that with the Gulf Coast being particularly vulnerable, that Texas would be just inundated with water and there wouldn't be a whole lot of it left. So she and her parents have to flee there, and they go to the middle of the country. And then because of political uprising, she has to flee further north. And then the other characters are a little bit closer to, I guess, in Seattle, because since I live in Seattle, that's where I start with my imagination, is what that might look like. So a little bit closer to the Canadian border. Sort of speculating on how the oceans becoming warmer and more acidic would change the climate there and would put pressure on people trying to move into that area, because mm-hmm. it would become very nice. It would be a lot like Southern California is right now.
And as it puts pressure on people, we have to also factor in the fact there are going to be a lot more people.
Exactly. A lot of people coming in, a lot of undocumented people, so that's a big deal. A lot of people trying to find a safer area to live, and how that might actually create instability and less security for everybody who's trying to find something that's safe.
Sometimes in anticipating where government is going, we forget about anticipating where the earth is going. Right?
Exactly. Well, and that's absolutely going to impact, you know, how the government reacts to people having to move around and what that might look like.
Well, that's a pretty apocalyptic vision.
It's true.
Not much, I guess not that much you can play for laughs and all that. But
no, I hope there's a couple of jokes that come across, but we'll see.
Well, at the same time, it's an important cautionary message, isn't it, Nicole?
It is. I really hope that people leave the theater wanting to discuss this more and think more long-term about the impact of their actions and the impact of the government actions, ultimately.
Well, let's hope it helps.
Yeah.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
L. Nicole Cabe will perform Tidal Surge this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at Next Door in downtown Honolulu, and details are on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for today's programming comes from Manoa Valley Theater, presenting Stage Kiss, a comedy about what happens when lovers share a stage kiss or when actors share a real one. Opening this Thursday, ManoaValleyTheater.com.
So this morning we had so many places that we went from on the fringe where you just were to right back into our backyards with so many issues that we're going to be dealing with, both through the Honolulu City Council and certainly with what happens as we open session next week.
And even, you know, both avant-garde artists that I spoke to today are really very much engaged with the kind of things that people on the political side are engaged with. I mean, it's there's no avoiding it, right?
And for a lot of people who feel that they're in overwhelm, sometimes being able to approach it through the arts may be a little easier entry than having to hit it squarely on the head, because we hear it and see it and people are feeling so much fatigue.
Yeah, find one thing you can understand at least, right?
Now we try to find a couple.
Yeah.
And we'll be back with you tomorrow to find a couple more. We're going to have a check-in with Hart's new leadership.
And a restaurant that serves bugs intentionally.
Oh, Got to sit through that one, eh? Okay. Well, in the meantime, we like to hear from you, and you can always call our talk back line and leave us your comments in your own voice. Just let us know your name, please, and the town from which you're calling. Our number is 808-792-8217. You can tell us anything about the station or about what you hear on the show, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
And if you missed any of this show or want to hear a past show, you can find them under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you back here in the morning for more of The Conversation. See you then.